Rock.com.
A lecture on the natural history of the Caucasian and Negro races, part 3. The anatomical and physiological differences between the Caucasian, the Malay, Mongol, Indian and Negro races have elicited a great deal of scientific research, and I might very well write an octavo on these points alone. Time, however, compels me to restrict my lecture to a parallel between the Caucasian and Negro races. I wish it further to be understood that my parallel will be limited to the race of Negroes which we see in this country, and which I shall presently describe. There are many other tribes in Africa which differ widely in colour, physical and intellectual characters. When the Caucasian and Negro are compared, one of the most striking and important points of difference is seen in the conformation of the head. The head of the Negro is smaller by a full tenth. The forehead is narrower and more receding, in consequence of which the anterior or intellectual portion of the brain is defective. The upper jaw is broader and more projecting. The under jaw inclines out and is deficient in chin. The lips are larger and correspond with the bony structure. The teeth point obliquely forward and resemble in shape those of carnivorous animals. The bones of the head are thicker, more dense and heavy, and the same fact exists with regard to the other bones of the skeleton. Dr. Gall, in his laborious researches, has established the important fact, which is now conceded, that there is in the animal kingdom a regular gradation in the form of the brain, from the Caucasian down to the lowest order of animals, and that the intellectual faculties and instincts are commensurate with the size and form. In animals where the senses and sensual faculties predominate, the nerves coming off from the brain are large, and we find the nerves of the Negro larger than those of the Caucasian. In other portions of the skeleton, differences no less marked are presented. The arm of the African is much longer than in the Caucasian. A Negro of 5'6" has an arm as long as a white man of 6 foot. The arm from the elbow to the hand is much longer in proportion than in the white man. His hand is longer, more bony and tendinous, the nails more projecting and stronger. The chest of the Negro is more compressed laterally and deeper through from before backwards. The bones of the pelvis in the male are more slender and narrow. The muscles on the sides of the pelvis are less full, but more full posteriorly. In the two races, the lower limbs are in their relative proportion reversed in their entire measurement. The legs of the African are shorter, but the thigh longer and flatter. The bones at the knee joint, instead of being straight, are jointed at an obtuse angle, pointing forward. The shape of the shin bone, the calf, the foot, and the heel are familiar to you all. Now it will be seen from this hasty sketch how many points of resemblance anatomists have established between the Negro and the ape. It is seen in the head and face, the arms and hands, the compressed chest, the bones and muscles of the pelvis, the flat, long thighs, the forward bend of the knee, in the leg, the foot, and the toes. In short, place beside each other average specimens of the Caucasian, Negro, and orangutan, and you will perceive a regular and striking gradation. Substitute for the Negro a Bushman, or Hottentot from the Cape of Good Hope, and the contrast is still stronger. In the Bushman, says Lichtenstein, all the deformities of the race are seen in an exaggerated degree. They are extremely diminutive. 4'6" high, their flat nose, high cheekbones, prominent chin, and concave visage give them much of the apish character, which is increased by their keen, vivid eye. Always on the alert, they spring from rock to rock with the activity of antelopes, sleep in nests, which they form in bushes, just like birds' nests, but seldom pass 2 nights in the same place. They live by depredation, or by catching wild animals, such as serpents, lizards, ants, and grasshoppers. They, too, have humps on their backs, like dromedaries. The difference to an anatomist between the Bushman, or Negro, and the Caucasian is greater than the difference in the skeletons of the wolf, dog, and hyena, which are allowed to be distinct species, or even the tiger and the panther. Now, can all these deep, radical, and enduring differences be produced by climate and other causes assigned? It is incumbent on those who contend for such an opinion to show that such changes either have taken place or that similar changes in the human race are now in progress. It is now 1700 years since the Jews were banished from their native country, and soon after this event, a colony of them settled on the coast of Malabar among a people whose colour was black. They were visited a few years ago by Dr. Claudius Buchanan, who states in his travels that in complexion, form, and features, they still preserve the characteristics of the Jews of Europe. The natives, too, are still unchanged. More than 1,000 years ago, a colony of Persians were driven into India by religious persecution. They settled among a people of black complexion. Like the Jews, they had been prevented by religious tenets from intermarrying with the natives. Their descendants, in that burning climate, we are informed by Colonel Wilkes, who is familiar with this people, are a fine race of men, perfectly Caucasian in complexion, form, and feature, altogether unlike those around them. The same facts are observed in the Portuguese colonies in Mozambique and Zanzibar on the eastern coast of tropical Africa, the Spanish settlements in tropical America, and the English settlements in the West Indies present the same facts. Great numbers have died from the effects of climate. Their complexion has lost its ruddiness, and their skins have become swarthy and bilious. Their frames have become attenuated, because nature never intended them for this climate, but their features are still the same. Their children are born fair, and if carried to a temperate climate, would remain so. Everything goes to prove that there is a limit to the effect of climate. The Caucasian, though affected to a certain extent by climate, cannot be transformed into a Negro, or a Negro into an orangutan. The Moors have inhabited some parts of tropical Africa from time immemorial, yet neither in complexion, feature, form, hair, or in anything else have they made any approximation towards the Negro. The Chinese, the Hindus, the Jews, the Gypsies, and numerous other tribes afford strong illustrations, but I have no time to dwell upon them. It is about 2 centuries since the Africans were introduced into this country. The 8th or 9th generation is now among us, and the race is unchanged. The Negroes have been improved by comforts and good feeding, which they have been unaccustomed to, but they are Negroes still. A large portion of Oceanica, where the climate is temperate and pleasant, is inhabited by Negroes, who no doubt have dwelt there for ages. New South Wales extends beyond the 39th degree of south latitude, and many parts of it have a remarkably healthy and delightful climate, yet the following is the description given by Malt Brun of its natives. New South Wales seems to offer 3 native varieties of inhabitants, all belonging to the race of Oceanian Negroes. in the neighbourhood of Glasshouse Bay, the savages have large heads, which in shape resemble those of the orangutan. Their very limited intellects, hairy bodies, and habitual agility in climbing trees seem to bring them very near to the ape character. What, too, are the facts with regards to the Aborigines of America? I will here give some facts from Dr. Morton's Crania Americana. Although, says he, the Americans possess a pervading and characteristic complexion, there are occasional and very remarkable deviations, including all the tints from a decided white to an unequivocally black skin. He shows also, by numerous authorities, that climate exerts a subordinate agency in producing these diversified hues. The tribes which wander along the burning plains of the equinoctial region have no darker skins than the mountaineers of the temperate zone. Again, the Puelches and other inhabitants of the megalanic region beyond the 55th degree of south latitude are absolutely darker than the Abipones, Maccabios, and Tobas, who are many degrees nearer the equator. While the Botocudes are of a clear brown colour, and sometimes nearly white, at no great distance from the tropic, and moreover, while the Guayacas under the line are characterized by a fair complexion, the Charruas, who are almost black, inhabit the 50th degree of south latitude, and the yet blacker Californians are 25 degrees north of the equator. After all, he adds, these differences in complexion are extremely partial, forming mere exceptions to the primitive and national tint that characterizes these people from Cape Horn to the Canadas. The cause of the anomalies is not readily explained, that it is not climate is sufficiently obvious, and whether it arises from partial immigrations from other countries remains yet to be decided. With respect to the Polynesian tribes, it has been remarked by Marsden and Crawford that the heat of the climate seems to have no connection with the darkness of the complexion. The fairest natives in most instances are those situated nearest to the equator. If we inquire into the history of the Papua and Australian tribes with relation to this point, we shall find that the complexion does not become regularly lighter as we recede from the intertropical clime, for the people of Van Diemen's Land, who are the most distant from the equator, are black. The Tartars are brown, and the Europeans white, in the same latitude. It is well known to the naturalist that the skins of the white and black races differ widely in their anatomical and physiological characters, but details on this point would here be out of place. The skin in all the races is composed of several lamina. The outer is called the cuticle and is thin and transparent. The second is a vascular network called the rete mucosum, and it is on this that the colour of the skin depends. It secretes a black pigment or paint which gives the black skin to the negro, and it will from this be seen that the blackness cannot be caused by the rays of the sun producing a change in its colour. In a sailor or outdoor labourer who is exposed to the sun, the skin is, as we express it, tanned or burnt, it becomes dark, but there is none of this pigment secreted, and the change in the father is not transmitted to the child. Another striking fact is seen in negro children. When born, they are almost as fair as a white child, but in a very short time, and without any exposure to the sun, this black pigment is secreted, and the skin becomes black. Here is a function different from any in the whites. The skin of the African, too, is known to generate less heat, and he therefore stands a hot climate better, and a cold worse than the white man. We are all familiar also with the bouquet odeur of a Negro's skin, which cannot be accounted for by accidental causes. In this discussion, great weight has been given to the admitted fact that the colour of the skin in the Old World is generally found to accord with climate. The white man is found in the cold and temperate regions, the black in the torrid zone, and the intermediate complexions between the two. There are, however, as we have seen, so many exceptions to the rule as to destroy it. Moreover, if different pairs of the human race, of different complexions and physical conformations, were placed by the Creator in the positions best suited to their organization, they would naturally multiply and spread. After a time, the different races would come in contact, mingle together, and form intermediate varieties. In fact, this is a picture of what is now going on all over the world. I have been often struck by the resemblance of the colored Creoles in New Orleans to the Mongol race. Many of them have the high cheekbones, oblique eyes, and other characteristics. If the position I take be true, that the human race is descended from several, or many, original pairs, it is reasonable to suppose that there is not at present a single unmixed race on the face of the earth. Look at the population of the United States. From how many nations have we received crosses? Read the early history of Great Britain, France, Germany, Egypt, in short, the whole world, as far as we have records. Who now can tell what blood predominates in each nation? Much stress has been laid upon the variety of complexions, hair, and conformation seen in what is supposed to be the same race. Take England, for example, where you find people of very different features and forms. The complexions vary from fair to tawny, and the hair from blonde to black. These facts have been cited to show that varieties spring up in the same race, which, if separated and allowed to multiply alone, would make permanent varieties as distinct as the Caucasian, Mongol, and Negro. But I would ask, how much of this may not be attributable to mingling of races originally different? Every man conversant with the breeding of horses, cattle, dogs, and sheep is aware of the effect of the slightest taint of impure blood. There are no data by which we can determine the length of time which it will endure. An English turfman will not own a horse whose pedigree cannot be traced back to the remotest records of pure blood, and what is remarkable, no horse has ever been the progenitor of successful runners who has been known to have one drop of impure blood in his veins. The celebrated racehorse Plenipo is a facsimile of one of his ancestors 8 generations back, and unlike the intermediate lynx. A strong likeness is sometimes remarked in racehorses to the Godolphin Arabian, who was brought to England over 100 years ago. Look at the family portraits of the Bourbon family and many others in Europe. Though they have been intermarrying with other families for generations, the likeness is still preserved. A very curious fact may be cited to prove how strong an impression is made upon the offspring by a cause too slight to be conceived of. It is known to be a fact that a mare has produced a colt from a quagga, and her next colt from a horse has been striped like a quagga, though having no relationship whatever that we can imagine. Man and animals are doubtless governed by the same general physiological laws, and no one can calculate the results which may arise from crossing races. My belief is that the human race are descended from original stocks, which were essentially different, that these original stocks were placed by an all-wise Creator in the climate and situation best suited to their organization. The black man was placed in tropical Africa because he was suited to this climate and no other. the white man, was placed in Europe and Asia for the same reason. I have elsewhere given facts to prove this. The statistics of our northern cities show that the proportion of deaths among the blacks compared to the whites is nearly 3-1. Facts of a different nature, and no less astounding, have recently been published in the Southern Literary Messenger, taken from authentic statistics. Among the slave population of Louisiana, the insane and idiots number 1 in 4,310. In South Carolina, 1 in 2,477. In Virginia, 1 in 1,299. But what a different picture is presented at the North. In Massachusetts, there is, in that class of population, 1 insane or idiot in 43. And in Maine, 1 in 14. Now, much of this is attributable to climate, but not all, as I shall show hereafter. In the northern cities, there is a large proportion of mulattoes, who I regard and shall attempt to prove are hybrids. These hybrids we know to be shorter-lived than the whites or blacks, and probably more prone to insanity. But the facts stand, and construe them as you please. They go strongly to prove the existence of distinct species in the human race. A hybrid offspring is the strongest and most unequivocal proof of the distinctness of species. The mule, for instance, is the hybrid offspring of the horse and the ass. Its inability to produce offspring and other peculiarities leave no doubt that the parent stocks are distinct species. In an article which I published in the July number of the American Medical Journal, I brought forward a number of facts to prove that the mulatto was a hybrid, and as a necessary inference, that the white and negro races were now, if not always, distinct species. As these facts are very intimately connected with the subject of the present lecture, I will here recapitulate them, with some additions, and I will first give an extract from a very sensible article published in the spring of 1843 in the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal, under signature of Philanthropist. The writer says, "From authentic statistics and extensive corroborating information, obtained from sources to me of unquestionable authority, together with my own observations, I am led to believe that the following statements are substantially correct. First, that the longevity of the Africans is greater than that of the inhabitants of any other part of the globe. Second, that mulattoes, those born of parents, one being African and the other white, of Caucasian, are the shortest lived of any class of the human race. Third, that the mulattoes are not more liable to die under the age of 25 than the whites or the blacks, but from 25 to 40, their deaths are as 10-1 of either the whites or blacks between those ages. From 40 to 55, the deaths are 50-1, and from 55 to 70, 100-1. Fourth, that the mortality of the free people of colour is more than 100% greater than that of the slaves. Fifth, that those of unmixed extraction in the free states are not more liable to sickness or premature death than the whites of their rank and condition in society, but that the striking mortality so manifest among the free people of colour is in every community and section of the country invariably confined to the mulattoes. It was remarked by a gentleman from the South, eminent for his intellectual attainments and distinguished for his correct observation, and who has lived many years in the southern states, that he did not believe that he had ever seen a mulatto of 70 years of age. From a correspondence published in the Boston Statesman in April last are taken the following statistics. in a coloured population of 2,634,348, including free blacks. There are 1,980 over 100 years of age, whereas there are but 647 whites over 100 in a population of 14,581,000. Dr. Niles, in a pamphlet published in 1827, gave a comparative statement of mortality in the cities of Philadelphia, New York, and Baltimore, deduced from official reports of the boards of health of the respective cities, from which it appears that in the years 1823, 4, 5, and 6, the deaths were as follows. New York, 1 in 40 whites, 1 in 18 blacks. Philadelphia, 1 in 3,182 whites, 1 in 1,991 free blacks. Baltimore, 1 in 4,429 whites, 1 in 32 free blacks, and 1 in 77 slaves. In Boston, the number of deaths annually among the coloured population is about 1 in 15, and there are fewer pure blacks in this city than any other. The same comparative mortality between mulattoes and blacks exists in the West Indies and Guyana, where unfavourable social causes do not operate against the mulattoes as in the United States. 15 years of professional intercourse and observation have led me to conclusions which correspond very closely with those of philanthropist. I would add, 1, that the mulattoes are intermediate in intelligence between the blacks and whites. 2, that they are less capable of undergoing fatigue and hardships than the blacks or the whites. 3, that the mulatto women are particularly delicate and subject to a variety of chronic diseases. 4, that the women are bad breeders and bad nurses. Many do not conceive. Most are subject to abortions, and a large portion of the children die young in the southern states. 5, that the two sexes, when they intermarry, are less prolific than when crossed on one of the parent stock. 6. That Negroes and mulattoes are exempt, in a surprising degree, from yellow fever. The subject of hybrids is a very curious one, on which much might be said, but we have space only for a few general remarks. There are a great variety of hybrids, running through the whole chain of animated nature, in both animal and vegetable kingdoms. Some hybrids do not breed, as the mule, for example. There are rare instances of their having propagated when crossed back on one of the parent stocks. There are other hybrids which do propagate perfectly as the offspring of the goat and the ewe, the goldfinch and canary bird, the Chinese goose and the common goose. Those hybrids which do breed, when bred together, have a tendency to run out and change back to one of the parent stocks. The hybrid geese, for instance, if kept alone, degenerate into common geese in a very few generations. This has been remarked, too, in the mulattoes of the West Indies, and there are now families in Mobile from the same parents, some of whom are nearly black, and others nearly white, where there is every reason to believe that the mothers have been faithful to their husbands. Another general law laid down by naturalists is that the hybrid derives its size and internal structure principally from the mother, a striking example of which is given in the mule. The mule, or offspring of the mare and ass, is a large and powerful animal, having the internal organization of the mother. The Bardot, or Hinny, on the contrary, the offspring of the horse and Jenny, is a small and comparatively worthless animal. Buffon, And other naturalists assert also that in hybrids the head resembles the father. A familiar illustration may be again seen in the mule. The offspring of the ass and mare has the long ears, large coarse head, expression, and other peculiarities of his dignified progenitor. In the Bardot, on the contrary, the head of the horse is preserved. It is long and lean, with short ears. This law has an important bearing on the subject now before us. It is well settled by naturalists that the brain of the Negro, when compared with the Caucasian, is smaller by a tenth, and is particularly defective in the anterior or intellectual lobes, and that the intellect is wanting in the same proportion. In the white race, the fact is notorious that the child derives its intellect much more from the mother than the father. It is an age-old remark that a stupid mother never produces an intelligent family of children. Look the world over and ask who are the mothers of the eminent men, and it will be found that there are few exceptions to the rule that the mothers are above, and most of them far above, mediocrity. But this important law of nature is reversed when the white man is crossed upon the Negress or Indian woman. The law of hybrids is shown at once. In the offspring, the brain is enlarged, the facial angle increased, and the intellect improved by a marked degree. Everyone at the South is familiar with the fact that the mulattoes have more intelligence than Negroes, make bad slaves, and are always leaders in the insurrections. Estwick and Long, the historians of Jamaica, both state unhesitatingly that the male and female mulatto do not produce together so many children as when they are united respectively to Negresses and Europeans. I am credibly informed that these facts are very strikingly verified in New Orleans, where there is a mixture of the races to great extent. I am told that it is not uncommon to see a family run out so completely as to leave estates without heirs to claim them. I have called attention in another part of my lecture to some interesting statistics to show the effect of cold climate and social condition combined in producing idiocy and insanity in the free blacks of the northern states. I have no facts yet to ground an opinion on, but I have little doubt that it will be found that these effects, like disease and early deaths, are confined mostly to the mulattoes. I have shown that in Maine, 1 in 14, and in Massachusetts, 1 in 43, are lunatics or idiots of the coloured population. As different hybrids are acknowledged to be governed by different laws, is it not reasonable to believe that the human hybrid may also have its peculiar laws? May not one of these laws be, which is a reasonable inference from foregoing data, that the mulatto is a degenerate, unnatural offspring doomed by nature to work out its own destruction? The statistics of philanthropists prove that the mulattoes are shorter lived, and it is an everyday remark at the South that they are more liable to be diseased and are less capable of endurance than either whites or blacks of the same rank and condition. What, then, could we expect in breeding from a faulty stock, a stock which has been produced by a violation of nature's laws, but that they should become more and more degenerate in each succeeding generation? We know that the parent will transmit to the child not only his external form, character, expression, and temperament, but diseases through many generations, such as insanity, gout, scrofula, and consumption. Why, then, may not that defective internal organization, which leads to ultimate destruction, exist in the mulatto? I believe that if 100 white men and 100 black women were put together on an island and cut off from all intercourse with the rest of the world, they would in time become extinct. It has been asserted by writers that when the grade of quintaroon is arrived at, all trace of black blood is lost, and they cannot be distinguished from the whites. Now, if this be true, most of the mulattoes must cease to be prolific before this point of mixture is arrived at. For although I have passed most of my life in places where the two races have been mingling for 8 or 9 generations, I have rarely, if ever, met an individual tainted with Negro blood in whom I could not detect it without difficulty. These higher grades should be extremely common if the chain was not broken by death and sterility. How else can the fact be accounted for? Veery, a distinguished French naturalist, states that the connections between the Europeans and women of New Holland are rarely prolific. The different tribes in Africa have been mixing together from time immemorial, and we have not yet any facts from which to form an opinion on the question whether there are affinities between certain races or species which make them intermix better than others, or to what extent the law of hybrids prevails. This remark applies to other parts of the world as well as Africa.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.